My father always told us, you never look down at anyone, you never look up at anyone. We are all the same, and everyone has a job to do. Whether you're a shoeshine boy, or you're a president, or a king, or a lawyer, whatever you are in life, you're working, and you have to respect every single person. So every single day, when you think you have resolved a big controversy, you go to bed happy. Next day you wake up and there's another one. So it's a complicated, and you can never please everyone. There's a few things. First of all, it's a reputation. It's a black cloud that it's always on top of boxing.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm joined by the head of the WBC, Maurizio Sulaiman. Maurizio became the leader of the WBC after the passing of his father, Don Jose, who I used to see a lot of in Las Vegas. And here I tried to get another side of Maurizio. Maurizio, the fight fan and boxing person, rather than Maurizio, the boxing politician. This interview was done in the midst of the Conor Benn saga, when no one was saying much at all, and as always is the case with this series of interviews, I try not to focus too much on current stuff, because this is an archive that is designed to be timeless and not littered with date stamps. I'm sure I'll get Maurizio down the line again, and I have questioned him heavily in the past on many of the topics we have covered in this podcast for written pieces. I really hope you enjoy this with Maurizio, and as always, huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. And Delco Safety Compliance provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Maurizio Sulaiman.
So Maurizio, thanks for joining me. Obviously, you are the figurehead of one of the world's leading boxing organizations. Is this what your dad wanted for you? Did your dad
Absolutely
want you? Did
it,
did he want this life for you?
No. When I was a little kid, for some reason, I became like his favorite. He would take me to press conferences, to interviews, to fights everywhere. He was my baseball coach, so he would travel so much all over the world that every second I could have with my father, I cherished it. And then I started trying to help him a little bit, you know, taking phone calls and messages and doing some letters, et cetera, traveling with him. And just when I graduated from college, I went directly to the family business to be the CEO of the family business, so my father could have all the time free for boxing, for the WBC. But as I was always close with him, boxing was always around, and I would continue to help him. And just little by little, I started getting more into the administrative and the more close, important stuff. But he would always tell me, go back to the factory and just help me with that. But then he would drag me back. But we had an agreement that it was not intended that I would become president at any time. When he passed away, he left a great memorial for so many people. People came from all over the world to say goodbye to him, thousands of people. And that's when my mother and my wife told me, well, you should not abandon the WBC. I decided to stay in whatever capacity I could do. But then the elections came for president just even a month before it had passed, and I was elected president. So it was not something that we planned. I feel happy because being in boxing keeps me very close to my father. And it's something that I do appreciate very much.
Was your father your hero?
My hero. He still is my hero. He left the doors open to me and my family when we go anywhere. Just saying we are the son of Jose Sulaiman, it brings a smile, great memories to so many people, respect, honorability, and that's my most important asset in life, to make sure that his legacy, his name, his integrity is kept intact. So it's something that motivates me, but it is 9 years already, but I still have my father right next to me, inside of me.
Were you also close to your mom as a kid, or were you your father's son?
No, also my mom. Thank God she's still alive. She's so beautiful, such a wonderful woman. She gave everything up to walk side by side with my father. As I said, he traveled so much. And she always stayed home. She took care of 6 siblings. You know, when you have kids, school problems and fights and all these situations that she always took. She never bothered my father. She never called him and said, oh, this happened or this happened. Always acted as father and mother. And it's just something that it's a very close family that we have.
Do you remember the first fight you ever saw, whether it was on TV or live?
I remember both. One, when I live, my father took me, I guess, to Arena Coliseo in Mexico City. I remember going into this dark alley, then into the arena, a hall that was very, you know, at that time, the lights were only in the ring. So the rest was mostly obscure. I remember people screaming and smoking all over the place. A very intimidating atmosphere for a kid. I must have been 3, 4, I'm not sure. And when I started seeing kids or men hitting each other, I was a little bit shaken. But by the 3rd round, 4th round, boxing got into me. And ever since then, and the television, I remember watching, I would think it was Muhammad Ali. Because he was black and white, and my brothers were in the living room. And I remember watching a fight that was very important, and it was in black and white. So it must have been maybe the Rumble in the Jungle. I'm not sure which fight it was.
At what point did you start to realize that your dad didn't have a regular job? You know, that he wasn't a dentist. He wasn't working in an office or a factory. He was going around and mixing with royalty and, you know, boxing royalty, but actual royalty and everything else. At what point did you start to realize this isn't normal? This is quite a special position that he has.
Not really. I never, my parents were very humble, very down to earth at all times. So we never realized my father had a position of importance. You know, he would be with Nelson Mandela, with the Pope, with so many presidents and kings. And still he would come home and be the father and be the baseball coach. At the time when he was elected president, he was creating the company, the business that we have. It's a manufacturing company. So he was partner of American corporation. He built the company, the manufacturing, and he would work, then he would do boxing, then he would travel, then he would do baseball, and he never at any time was tired. My memory I have of him is him sitting down in the living room or the table, just working at all times. But he was so beautiful. He was very close. He liked to hug us and kiss us. And I think in elementary school, I remember one teacher, my good friend, Jose Cantoral. He's the son of a great composer, very famous in Mexico. And I remember this teacher saying, "You, Sulaiman, and you, Cantoral, don't you think that you are blah, blah, blah?" And we were saying, what did we do? But never, ever have we felt. My father always told us, you never look down at anyone. You never look up at anyone. We are all the same. And everyone has a job to do. Whether you're a shoeshine boy or you're a president or a king or a lawyer, whatever you are in life, you're working and you have to respect every single person.
So did you have a normal childhood, or did you travel a lot with your dad? And were you here, there, and everywhere traveling, or were you in school all the time, or was it a combination of the two?
No, as a child, we would travel very little. We had very few family vacations, in reality. But my father was always away. But my mother, as I said, she was there. We had to do school. We had to be good citizens. And we didn't get to travel much. We would go every December to meet my father's side, my grandfather on my father's side, for Christmas and New Year's. During the summer, we would go to my mother's side. Both lived in different provinces. So basically, those were our vacations, only going to see the family. And as a child, I was very sports. I used to play baseball and soccer, football, and always with friends. So it was not a normal childhood, because, as you say, my father was not there, and he was not a go to the office and come back home and be with the kids. It was a different scenario. But it was always balanced between my mother, my father, and then the family and my brothers and all the friends that we had.
At what point did you start meeting some famous fighters, you know, like Muhammad Ali or Julio Cesar Chavez and these guys? Do you remember any early meetings with any fighters where you were in awe?
Yes, I must have been 3 years old. I'm not sure how old I was. And I was upstairs and I heard a very loud, crazy noise. I didn't know what was that. So I came running down. And I found my father in the living room with two huge men. It turned out it was Muhammad Ali and Don King. The noise was Don King laughing, that famous laughter that he has. And every single time that my father was home, we would get visits from the amateurs or trainers or managers just starting up. Or we would come back from school and we would have Sugar Ray Leonard having lunch at the house, Roberto Duran, Mike Tyson, Oscar De La Hoya, Muhammad Ali, promoters, managers, trainers, all my life. So ever since I can remember, I was able to meet in a very intimate and close manner Alexis Arguello, Roberto Duran, Hagler, Hearns, everyone. So that's a thing that I really, really enjoy knowing that I went through.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great story, isn't it? I mean, to think when you're a kid, when you're trying to say that you're having a normal childhood and you go downstairs and Muhammad Ali and Don King are in your front room with your dad.
Yeah, and I remember my hero was Sugar Ray Leonard. So when he lost to Roberto Duran, he came to Mexico to ask my father for the rematch. And I remember coming back home from school, and there he was, having a lunch in the family dining table, and I'm just like very excited. So when he gets up and they're about ready to leave, I'm just looking at him like he was a god. So he looks at me and I say, like, I go like this. So he goes and he puts up his, and he lets me touch it. So it was like an unbelievable moment for me.
I was like flexing his muscles.
Yeah, flexing his muscles. And I touch and I was like, oh, he's a real man, Superman.
What about those early meetings with Mike Tyson? Was it, I guess that was, yeah, how early was that? Just after he won the title, around that sort of time?
Yeah, I met Mike Tyson on Fight Week when he defeated Burbick. Okay. I was going to school in Massachusetts. It was Thanksgiving, and I had nowhere to go, so my father flew me to Las Vegas, and I had the great experience to be in that crowning of Mike Tyson against Burbick.
Wow, so that's interesting.
We became friends immediately. He was 20 years old. I was 16, 17. And we just took it up. He was quiet, nice. And he went to Mexico several times. So we have been very good friends for a long time.
So you said about education in Massachusetts. How did that come about? Why did you go to Massachusetts from Mexico?
It's a long story. My family origins is from Lebanon. So my grandfather, when he was 3 years old, he was left behind in Lebanon by his parents, who traveled to America to look for a new life. When he was 20, they sent him a ticket for a ship to join them in America, in Boston. They landed in Boston, Massachusetts. So my grandfather, his friends tell him, oh, let's change your ticket so we'll go together. So he changed his ticket for a few days later, but that ship landed in Mexico instead of Massachusetts. So my grandfather ended up in Mexico. It took him 4 years to go and meet his parents and his family. But on the way, trying to get it, going to the United States, he met my grandmother. So he fell in love and he stayed. He came back from Boston, but we have family in Massachusetts. So all of us as kids, we went to study high school in Massachusetts.
Wow. So have you traced your family tree back to Lebanon? Do you know about your great grandparents? Yes. Have you? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. We still have a house in Lebanon that was left from my father to my father. The house is still there. But I have not traveled to Lebanon. That's one of my dreams to go.
Do you still have the house you were brought up in? That your mum and dad's house? Do you still own that house? Yeah.
Yes. Is that... I live in two houses. Up to when I was born, up to 12 years old in one house. Then we moved three blocks away to the new house, which is currently the WBC office.
Okay.
When my father passed away, we decided to make it the WBC office.
So you obviously said about Don King being at your family house. Tell me about your dad's relationship with Don King, because that's quite a controversial subject for some people. Obviously, you know, writers like Thomas Hauser and stuff have talked about improprieties with, you know, with them being very close in the past, right?
They were very, very close. Don King, without a doubt, one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest promoter ever. But it was a very explosive relationship. My father always, I remember always getting into arguments with Don King over the phone or in person. It was a great time of boxing, where Don King promoted some of the greatest events And many of those fights were WBC fights. Of course, there's a relationship between the promoter and the organization. There's a topics that are always discussed, and when there's decisions that you take, you benefit one party and you do not benefit one or more parties. So there's always going to be controversy. And boxing is a sport in which there's always the conspiracy theory. There's people that like to always try to see there's something wrong or something behind, obscure. But history tells itself. If you review the history, then you can see the reality of what has happened in sport.
So, yeah, I find it really interesting, obviously, in your position, because you know, obviously your dad was your hero, but in for some people in boxing, he was quite a divisive figure too. You obviously saw a lot of the good he did, and we've talked in the past about the safety measures that he's implemented that came through the WBC with the studies at UCLA and that kind of stuff. I mean, is that something that you could just refresh me about the stuff that the WBC did in terms of fighter safety? And I think it was after the Mancini Duke Koo Kim fight, or maybe even before that.
Before that, you know, my father was born in a small town in the province, and his friends were fighters. So he was invited to watch a fight. He didn't have a ticket, so they told him to go in, but he had to go into the ring and fight another kid for 1 round, 1 minute. That's how he started in boxing. His best friends were fighters. Then his uncle was a doctor of the commission. So he started in the commission helping with every single aspect. He was a go-to boy, ring announcer, referee, judge, everything that you can imagine in the ladder of boxing, he experienced it. But most importantly, he lived in the times where boxing was a savage sport, inhuman. The abuse for the fighters was terrible. And he experienced everything firsthand. And he always thought that if he ever had a position where he could make changes, he would do that. So when they elected him president in 1975, he made clear to the WBC that he would accept only if he was given absolute support to reform the sport. He was a visionary, and he cared for the fighters more than anything in life. He did medical research in UCLA in the 1970s, especially 77, 78. So what we see today, it's the result of many years of changes and rules and procedures that the WBC led. So 15 to 12 rounds before the fights, where the weigh-in was 6 hours before the fight. Before, there was no anti-doping tests. There were no medicals. The ring had three ropes instead of four. The gloves, they used 6 ounce gloves, which was unbelievable, dangerous, and you could use smelling salts to
bring a fighter, you know, revive a fighter. Yeah,
by the fighter, if he was knocked down and the bell ended, they would drag him and revive him, and so many things that led to deaths in the ring or a poor quality of life for the fighters. So my father dedicated his absolute everything, his life, to boxing, and we were all there to see how everything happened.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There was a lot of really good stuff in there, Maurizio. And was there a point where your dad sat you down and gave you some advice, or did you learn from your father by watching him do what he did?
Mostly it was by watching him, but once in a while he would make sure that the us get it. He gave us few advice. He always asked us to be united in every aspect: family, the brothers, the cousins, everything. And whatever thing you did in life, you have to look for unity instead of disruption or breaking away. United makes a great force. And he told us how the principles and the values of life, loyalty is the most important. If you are not loyal, then you are nothing in life. And loyal means it's a very powerful, extensive concept. It's a noun, it's a verb, it's everything. But it's a way of living. It's so easy to be loyal when things are going right to your friend, to your wife, to your company, to your peers. But it's so easy also to become disloyal and leave when things go wrong. So those who are loyal in whatever capacity are the ones that really stick up and have a great value. So when you're loyal, you do things and you cannot expect anything in return. Boxing is complicated. There's so many vested interests, and sometimes people have to take decisions that you would say it's an act of betrayal or disloyalty. But you have to analyze. You have to understand if a fighter who is very close to you, good friend, and then next day he goes to another organization. Well, maybe that was a great opportunity for him to make money, to become champion. But you have to be very sensitive of the surroundings of what happened and not make judgment. Just always be friend, be loyal.
It's really interesting you say that, Maurizio, because, you know, there's such a thing as blind loyalty. Do you know that, blind loyalty? Do you know that phrase? Yes. And it's kind of where you're so loyal that you're loyal to people even if they're at fault. And I suppose maybe, and I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but that's probably a good example of where your principles come from. Because I would say sometimes in the past, you maybe have been too loyal to people because of their families or because of your relationship with them, where they've done something bad. But then because of your loyalty to them, you've overseen or you've looked beyond anything negative that they've done because you're loyal to them. Do you see what I mean? But then I can see you know, with what you've told me there, I kind of understand where your principles come from within the family.
Yeah, there's a very thin line between being loyal and doing something improper. So it is much more higher to do what is proper and what is right and not get blinded by that loyalty that you mean. And but there's a very thin line. I agree with you. When you are loyal, when you are you know, how can I explain? I'm lost the word in English, but it is a matter of principles, and it is gratifying because someone can be loyal and go unnoticed for many years, and then one day it pops up and you realize how that person has been there with you as a friend, or how your wife has been there always supporting you, and you have abandoned some matters of a relationship or with a company. You know, when you work for someone and you have a roof under you, my father used to say, our company is a tree that provides shadow to all the families that work for you. So it is a very, very intimate relationship that we always have created as Sulaiman with whomever we are associated, whether it's in the company, with our employees, with our co-workers. In boxing, I see the fighters like brothers, like nephews, like cousins. And that's how we grew up. So it's everything about the fighter. It will always be about the fighter.
And I suppose when we talk about treading that thin line, it's interesting because you don't, because you're the sanctioning body, you are your own boss, so you can do as you see fit. You know, you can make, you know, you got, I'm not going to say you make the rules up as you go along, but you can make the rules up as you go along because you're the boss.
No, we have a constitution. We have rules and regulations. We have absolutely a rule to go by in all the aspects of the sport. My father, you know, I would question him because I saw the relationship with, for example, the champion. And then you see the challenger coming in with so much wishing, so many dreams to win that title. And then you see that there's a new champion. And I would see my father acting with both the interaction. And I would always, that's one of the greatest educations I received. You have to be loyal to your champion and to your challenger because he wants your title. And if he wins, he deserves, and he will become the WBC champion. So when you go into the ring, always go to the corner of the fighter who lost and recognize his bravery, his value, and empathize with him. And then you go with the winner and celebrate his victory. So at the same moment, you are happy and you are sad, but it's a sincere feeling. That is very hard to describe.
When I was covering, so I covered a lot of fights in Las Vegas when your father was working. And obviously it became clear that your dad was having struggles with poor health towards the end. And he was on a scooter and things like that. That had to be very hard for you to see his health failing, right?
You know, he was... he had the issue with the knee.
Yep.
And so he was in a wheelchair and a scooter and all this. Then it became harder to get into the ring and come out of the ring. But he loved it. I mean, he was so passionate. If you wanted to help him out, you know, to one step, he would take your... He was very proud.
Stubborn.
And stubborn and proud and powerful. And at the same time, he was like a little kid. If he saw ice cream, he would just want the ice cream. So it was, I enjoyed every second I spent with my father. And I never saw him weak at all. When he died fighting like a champion. He had a very difficult 3.5 months, but he was a fighter. That's when I really understood what he was, a never die, never lose attitude. So he will always be very present in my life and many others' lives.
When you were elected, did you think you were going to be elected? Did you think it was you?
No. I truly believed I was going to continue as the executive secretary. But in the event, it was by acclamation. There was no voting. Nobody, there was no one else who tried or
step forward.
Had a step forward to. So it's just an election, like acclamation. But most of the board members, I knew since I was a little kid. So I respect them. They have been my mentors in many ways. And the respect that I have for every board member is above and beyond any feeling that I could have as a president. I respect them. The board is above me. They are the ones who make the ultimate decisions. And I just mediate and facilitate the things and bring them to them to make the final voting and rulings.
Is the job as president, is it harder than you thought it was going to be or the same? Or was it exactly as you expected?
You know, the first couple of years, were extremely easy. For some reason, my father's passing away, people in you know, the boxing commissions, the promoters, the media, opened their arms to me and their heart for some reason. I was given a very warm welcome without, I did not expect it to be. But then things started settling in, and the controversies and the problems. And then you understand what the position is all about. There is never a dull moment in boxing. And especially we have so many things going on at the same time. It is the world championship. We have the silver. We have the women's division. We have the Muay Thai and all the regional championships, the Continental Americas, the international title, the youth world title, and all the regions have championships. We have so many committees that we have and we work, the medical committee, the legal committee, ring officials, the evaluation, the technical committee. During the conventions, we make many, many agreements that we have to administer throughout the year. And then you have the so many difficulties in one fight, you know, the gloves, the weight, the local commission, the appointments of referees and judges. And then the fighters get into disputes. So every single day, when you think you have resolved a big controversy, you go to bed happy. Next day you wake up and there's another one. So it's a complicated, and you can never please everyone.
Do you have a most stressful moment from being president? Is there a most stressful period that you've had so far?
Yeah, there have been a couple. Miguel Cotto did not accept to abide by the WBC rules. So on fight week, we took away the recognition of him as a champion. Canelo did not accept to fight the mandatory Triple G. So we had to take away the title from Canelo. Povetkin failing a test 1 week before the fight against Wilder. That was a big, big problem that took more than a year into the attention. And when a fighter gets injured, that is the most trouble moment that anyone in boxing can go through. Seeing an injury in the ring, it's very, very difficult.
And do you have any decisions that you regretted, that if you could do something differently, you would do it over again?
No, I don't think so. I believe, of course, we have made mistakes. I cannot point one this moment, but of course I have made mistakes. I'm human. The board is human. Everybody is human. But the decisions that we take are based on justice and based on safety. The decisions not always are popular. And I understand that. I fully understand that. I always say we are not in a popularity contest. If a decision infuriates a set group of promoters or managers or trainers, fans, media, that decision, well, the only thing I can say is that decision was based on safety or justice. And it is not always what people want to see. They want to see blood. They want to see the axes taken out and cut the heads of without understanding, without knowing the full facts. So it's a sensitive issue always.
You know, people were, we talked about this before, people were infuriated with the Kinahan thing when you had the photo of Kinahan. I suppose that would be what something that you could do. If you could do that differently, maybe that would have worked out differently, right?
Well, I meet so many people. I'm in Saudi Arabia right now. And yesterday I met 50, 80 people. I took pictures, and I don't regret. I go to Mexico, I go to Ireland, I go to England, I go to everywhere. I meet people, I greet them. I do not look at them down or up, as my father said, and it's just natural. And that's, of course, that's one thing that, I mean, I was very naive. I was stupid. I put a picture and I wrote about it. But that tells you I had absolutely no feelings, ill feelings or anything negative. You know, I meet people everywhere. So it's a thing that happens.
You know, that is one of the things in terms of boxing as a whole. You know, I still speak to people who aren't in boxing, but they say, oh, boxing, it's a dirty business and stuff. Like, that's the reputation the sport's got from the outside looking in. How do we change that? How do we get people to say, oh, you know, that's like, you know, whether it's soccer or tennis or whatever it is, how do we get that more wholesome identity for the sport?
There's a few things. First of all, it's the reputation. It's a black cloud that it's always on top of boxing. From the 30s, 40s, 20s, whatever, they claim that fights were fixed, or that the promoter would tell the fighter, would threaten him or pay him money to do this or that. And there's people that say it's a fact. When the WBC was created, the ultimate decision was very clear. A sanctioning organization will have nothing to do, zero, with the business side of the sport. Contrary to football, to baseball, to the NFL, to hockey, basketball, any other sport, the organization itself, FIFA, IOC, they control the business side. Television rights, the selling of the teams, the franchises, sponsorship, and they control the rules, and they control everything that has to do with the sport. So there's margin for a conflict of interest. In boxing, the authority has absolutely nothing to do with the business side, with the selling of television, with the site, with the tickets, with the sponsorship. We only have to do with the rules and the safety and the administration and the championships. So boxing is not an industry. It doesn't work like an industry. It's all independent. So you have promoter A wishing that promoter B next card is a failure, instead of promoter A, B, C, and Z hoping that the next promotion is a great success, so the sport goes up together. Media, TV commentators, they are so used to trash the sport. How can you expect the fan to respect the sport that it is always being trashed publicly by the media? I'm not saying everybody, but if you watch a fight, it is very common to see the commentators misleading. Oh, I wonder how this judge is going to see the fight. And then they are scoring themselves. Who says that they know how to score a fight? So when the end result is different from what the television thought, it's a controversy. So there's so many aspects, but the problematic is that we're all disrupted, all separated. Promotions all over the world, but not in a way integrated. And there is no code of ethics. But the reality is that boxing is a great sport. I am not familiar. I have never seen a criminal act, a act of corruption. I have seen in other sports, and they are very open. In baseball, a team stole the signals. They were a $5 million penalty, but they kept the championship. And in soccer, they have proven betting scandals on referees in different leagues. So it's something that boxing always will be that bad sport in the public image, because we are doing it wrong, everyone.
You and I have worked together a lot over the past. Okay, so you will know that I'm one of the straight journalists that sometimes gives you a hard time, right? And so I appreciate you being on the call. But the main reasons why I get fed up with boxing, which maybe you're calling me one of the negative guys, I don't know, but is the split of the titles. It's confusing to know who are the champions. Obviously, this is a widely known thing. You know, I couldn't name all the world champions from all the governing bodies. And I'm supposed to be an expert. The light punishment of PEDs, or if there is punishment, you know, banning someone for 6 months when they fight twice a year, or backdating punishment so they're not punished. You know, these guys need to miss serious chunks of their career, you know, 2-3 years at least of their prime. And then the best not fighting the best. You know, I think Ring Magazine have just done a cover for, you know, Crawford and Spence not happening, Garcia and Tank not happening, and you know, now we've lost Taylor and Catterall over in this country, and these guys aren't fighting each other, and it's really frustrating, these things with the PEDs, the split of the titles, the best not fighting the best. It's hard to get behind it when in soccer you have last, you know, Man United playing Barcelona or Real Madrid playing Liverpool. We have fighter A fighting a mandatory who might be a top 10 guy, but he might not be.
Yeah, the topics that you mentioned are complicated, because it is not something that there's a direct resolution or response. We cannot control how many organizations there are. We cannot control. We cannot say we cannot stop anyone from creating a new organization. It all became... from the WBA came the IBF, and then from the WBA, the WBO. It was the internal problems, and they created new organizations. And television, they demand to the promoters, we want championship fights. And then the promoters go to sponsors and sell championship fights. So I am absolutely frustrated. That's why we always try to have unification bouts. If it was for us, we would be all unified champions all around. But what happens is the disruption, when you have a unified champion or undisputed champion, then the politics of each organization and the mandatories and the pressure from one side or the other, then you start losing those unified championships. The PED, as you mentioned, the WBC created the Clean Boxing Program. We have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, or I don't even know how much, and so many headaches and problems in this. We are the only one from the four organizations that has an anti-doping out of competition. The British Boxing Board of Control has one. Some boxing commissions in the United States do some testing, but in reality, there's very little testing. For every world championship fight, it is mandatory to have a anti-doping test after the fight. That's for the fight. But we implemented the out of competition with WADA in 2015-16. We have performed, last year we performed 550 tests. So we have performed many, many tests, and we have education. We have a webinar. And as I say, why would we do this if we are not committed to safe boxing? Safe boxing is one of the keys. And every single case is different. It's independent one from the other, because the substances because of the situation surrounding what happened, how it happened, how the process of the investigation unfolds. So every case is different. And I understand. I am a fan of sports. When I watch a football game, like in the World Cup, even with VAR, I saw a couple of calls saying, why did they not call for a penalty kick in this one and why they did on this one? So as a fan, you're always critical. And I understand. And I respect the fans. I respect the media. All I can say is that we do things by the book. We do things with justice. And we do things honorably. Our great moral authority in the sport and in every aspect is that we make decisions without any interest behind. We don't benefit one way or the other. So,
do you think there will come a point with PEDs where you have to take a really strict line, though, and say, you know, I think they call it strict liability, where, you know, if it's in your system, too bad, you know, whatever, because obviously we are very familiar now with excuses, whether it's wild boar or tainted meat or tea or now eggs. You know, at what point do you think, well, no, it doesn't matter where it's come from. Fact is, it's in your body, so you're banned. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I don't agree with that. Our protocol, which is online, I don't know if you have read it. If you're familiar with it, I'll be happy to send it to you. It's very clear. We are, as I said, for justice. Let me tell you, it would be so easy to do that and then be the hero. But what happens with the athlete when there's an injustice? And I'm going to tell you an example. In 2011, there was a Junior World Cup in Mexico, soccer, football. And they performed 209 anti-doping tests of several teams from all over the world. 130 came positive for clenbuterol. So it was dismissed. It was clear that there was a meat contamination. It's a reality. Clenbuterol is fed to cows in some ranches, and it is a reality. So when Canelo tested positive, let's go back. When Vargas tested positive for clenbuterol, we talked to California, and we said, we spoke to the kid. He ate exactly this thing on a broth that his mother made, beef broth with a lot of meat. He ate because he arrived from training camp to say goodbye to the family for a week and then went back. He ate at night and he had it for lunch next day. And that day he got tested out of competition. So we talked to California. We agreed on a strict protocol for the rest of the 2 months before the fight, and the fight took place and was a fight of the year. Canelo, same thing. Clenbuterol. So we went through it. We took heat. People still call me and they make fun of Canelo and that he's a drug cheat and the WBC, blah, blah, blah. Today, WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, which is the one that creates the rules for doping, they have already changed clenbuterol threshold. They moved it up, understanding the situation in China, in Mexico, in a few other countries. So the work that we do is cannot be compromised. And if the Conor Benn case has infuriated people, so be it. We will not act with injustice. We had the whole process. I am not a scientist. I cannot respond to technicalities, but that was a ruling that came from a panel of experts. So I wish I could be popular and say the easy thing, but I'm not going to change the WBC structure.
Just one specific on that. I know this isn't what we're talking about, so I appreciate. I'm not going to go on a deep dive in Conor Benn, but just to clear up, we're referring to this, the two positives, right? And you're referring to the first positive, which was WBC and the VADA test, and then there was another positive, which I think UCAD and the Border Control still need to investigate. Is that right?
Both tests were under VADA.
Okay.
One was a clean boxing program, and the other one was contracted for the fight. But both tests were on the VADA testing protocol.
So your verdict, is that based on the first and the second, or just on the first, because that was the clean boxing program?
Everything was taken in consideration on the investigation.
Okay. And then, you know, something we've talked about in the past, obviously with my book Damage, do you feel bad sometimes when you go to these gatherings of old fighters, and you must have been around them now for 40 or more years, and you see some of them are damaged and hurt from the sport, you know, signs of Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, ALS, and other neurodegenerative disease. Do you feel bad? Not necessarily for your involvement, but you feel bad that, you know, you're okay. I mean, kind of like I do. I feel bad at some of these functions where these guys have sacrificed so much and now they're struggling.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a great motivation when we have interaction with them to continue trying to find ways of making boxing safer. I feel proud to see how that state of fighters is becoming much more less. Because undoubtedly, the changing from 15 to 12 rounds and the weighing and the several changes that have been implemented in boxing has much changed the quality of life of fighters after the ring. We are very active with fighters outside. We have the Jose Sulaiman Boxers Fund to aid fighters during difficult times in many aspects, in many ways. We have charity programs. We have the many social responsibility programs. And we are always close to our fighters, regardless if they're champions or no champions, WBC or not WBC. We try to always keep them in the limelight and give them recognition and make them feel good and keep them active. But absolutely, it's a motivation to continue to see where we can cut edges to make it more safe.
So when we speak about the fighters the WBC looked after, when we spoke in Kiev about Damage, you were saying, you know, the WBC can't look after everyone. We need to look after the guys that have fought for our titles and that kind of stuff. But I have subsequently learned that you did help and do help other fighters that never fought for the WBC. I remember Brenda Spinks, Leon Spinks's widow, telling me how much you helped her. Off the record, she was just saying, you know, that you've been a massive help to her. And I don't think Leon was ever a WBC champion, but it was, it goes to show that you are helping other people that aren't just the WBC people.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. We support. Even if you were only an amateur fighter or a four-rounder, six-rounder or a champion or a legend, it's unfortunate. You know, the life, you cannot control how people live their own life. And if a boxer after training goes and drinks, that's going to damage. If you're active and you drink,
you can't get brain issues. Yeah.
It's swollen. So next day you go sparring, it's going to make more damage. If after the fights you go and drink and have a difficult life and doing different things, then it pays the bill when you get older. But all I can say, the boxer is the most honorable human being. They come from very difficult backgrounds, from very difficult upbringings. And they give their lives for the benefit of the fans, for the benefit of everyone. and they should be always recognized, and hopefully everyone would understand that the money they make most likely will be used for the rest of their lives, because they don't know, most of them, they don't know what else to do.
I've got a couple more, Maurizio, then I'm going to let you go, because I appreciate you making the time to do this. How close did the WBC come to not existing with the Russia Gianni case? Did it nearly have to fold?
One day. It came to one day. It was a judgment that we could make a movie about it. There should be a movie about it. An award of $34 million to Rocky Gianni, when Rocky Gianni payment to the WBC was $6,000. I mean, that's the fees that he paid for the only fight he did. And then he was awarded $34 million for whatever happened. We had so much evidence and it was thrown out, whatever. So we were ordered to go to Chapter 11. Are you familiar with Chapter 11?
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, we had bankruptcy. To restructure. Yeah, there's two. The Chapter 11, it allows you to restructure the debt and then prove to the court that you can continue to operate. And they rejected it. So they said, you have 30 days to disintegrate the WBC. And it was a meeting that my father had at 1 day before the deadline that reached a final negotiation and saved the WBC.
Wow. Wow. Hopefully you don't have anything quite that stressful on your agenda.
Well, we live in a world that is highly litigious. We have been dealing with a legal issue for 3 years. But now I believe with the incorporation of the Court of Arbitration, which was a great, great decision of the WBC. My father, as I said, he was a visionary. So today, any matter must go to CAS. And that's the only way to resolve any situation, through CAS, not through legal court of
Is that three-year case, is that in the public domain, or is that something people don't know about?
No, everybody knows, but
which one is that?
No, I don't want to mention. you can
okay, I'll dig it out.
You can
okay. And then I suppose, do you know about the Ringside Charitable Trust in the UK? Have you heard of that?
Ringside Charitable Trust?
Yes.
Is that the song of the fighters?
Yeah, so yeah, I mean partly, yes. Yeah. So the guys, John H. Tracy and all of those guys did release a song, but they're trying to help retired fighters. They are
they want to build a home.
That's right, yes.
They want an hospice, a home where retired fighters can go and get treatment. We're part of that. This song, Never Give Up.
That's it,
it's sensational. So we are trying to encourage everyone to play that song and to be part of this movement, because it is something so honorable. Very, very special.
Are you helping them? Are you working with them? Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. We want to buy CDs. You know, every download will make money, and every time it's played. So I'm hoping every British promoter plays that song before the fights. That would be very helpful. And it's very nice. It's so many champions. The video is great. The champions singing. It's something that Simon Block, he's a good singer.
And that's right. He's done a lot of stuff from the WBC conventions, hasn't he? Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And he's the one that created the song. He plays the guitar, and it's very, very motivational. We must support it.
Okay. And then me being the straight shooting journalist, I'd say I'd be remiss of me to say I've seen the belt that you've put out for the Fury Jake Paul fight. I would rather that money was donated to Ringside Resting Care, Ringside Charitable Trust, and stop making those belts and give the money to the old fighters. But talking of the old fighters,
let's talk about the belt. It is a trophy. It's not a championship. We're celebrating Saudi Arabia supporting boxing with this event. You're going to have also a WBC championship fight that had would not happen if it was not for this Jake Paul, Tommy Fury fight. And then you're going to have a girl from Saudi Arabia fighting and eight other fighters from Saudi Arabia fighting. So we support whatever comes to the sport that is good. We support it. And it's a trophy. So it's nothing confusing. There's no sanction fees. There is nothing. And we give plenty of money to charity all over the world. So don't worry about that.
Okay. But talking of the ex-fighters, just in closing then, obviously I mentioned Kiev, where I went to the WBC convention and interviewed you for Damage. And now in Kiev, it's a very, very different place from when we were there several years ago. I just wanted you to speak a little bit about Vitali Klitschko and the work he is doing on the front line as one of the figureheads of Kiev, of the Ukrainian community.
Vitali is a hero. Vitali Vladimir Usyk, Lomachenko, Vozdik, the boxing community, they're all heroes, and we are so sad. It's 1 year already since invasion. You were in Kiev, and I'm sure you remember a dinner that there were some auction items, and we had very nice items that were auctioned. The money that was raised was used to build a sports complex. It was going to be opened last year in May, officially opened. It had already operations, and it was destroyed by a missile. And so many innocent lives have been lost. A boxing coach lost his life in an attack. Fighters have lost their lives, and it is unbelievable that in 2023, we're going through an invasion and a war. The WBC has done as much as possible to support morally, financially, and in the sports decisions. But it's heartbreaking because a country that Kiev is or was known as the number one of trees per square meter in the world. And now everything is going and vanishing, and it's all rubbles. It's heartbreaking. And it is something that is troubling so many people in the world. We're praying for peace.
You have spoken to Vitali, right? In the last year, you speak once in a while.
Yes, we speak constantly. And he's such a hero. He's so strong. So confident, his face changes so much from time to time, and I cannot imagine what he's going through every single day of his life, and I feel very bad about it.
On an uptick, if you could wave a magic wand and change anything in boxing, this is the last one that I promise, wave a magic wand and change anything in boxing, what would you change right now?
Oof. To say change is a very general. What? I don't know. It's a good one. But if we would work together, television, promoters, sanction organizations, everyone who is involved, that would make a huge difference. There's so much personal ego, abuse of power, and greed everybody has to lower expectations in order to make something happen. Otherwise, you don't want that fight to happen. So the most important thing are the fights, what happens in the ring. And we need to see the big fights happening. It's hurting the sport. What I would love to see is free television for boxing as it was before. The big fights cannot happen without pay-per-view, but that hurts the fans. Well, it's a complicated matter.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm satisfied with that. There's so many complicated matters in boxing. We could be here all day, but I'm sure it won't be long before we talk again about maybe one of the things we've discussed today. But thank you so much for making the time to speak to me. I appreciate it. And all the best with your travels. I hope the rest of your journey is a safe one.
Thank you so very much. And thank you for inviting me and having the opportunity to clear or explain some things. And I appreciated the first section. You made me remember my father and my childhood. Yeah. I have a lot of white hair here.
Not too much. Okay. Thanks, Maurizio. Okay, take care.
All the best. All
right. Bye-bye. Bye.
So that was really interesting by Maurizio. I really got a sense of pride and loyalty, even if you could make a case for it at times being misguided. It really gave me a better understanding of him. And I was grateful for his time. Maybe we do need a separate deep dive on the mechanics of the sanctioning bodies and so forth, but we'll see. Thanks to Maurizio for taking the time to do it. And thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee continue to be proud sponsors of Boxing Life Stories, but they help find you the best people and they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Boxing Life Stories is also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide, and they provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. While I'm thanking people, thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week.